on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
And thank you for joining us wherever you are across the globe. Later in the evening, a little warning, towards the end of the evening, we have cricket on the ABC, and if you wish to listen to Sunday Nights right through, you can do so on the World Wide Web, abc.net.au/Sunday Nights across the globe. And increasingly each week we're having a number of participants from across the world participate in the program by way of the Inquisition and other things. Well, tonight on Sunday Night, a debate about dying that continues to injure the living. Euthanasia. Each week, new cases are brought before the courts of assisted suicide. Those already grieving, whether they be partners, friends, carers, or even doctors, are open to the possibility of severe criminal penalty in what can only be described as culturally sanctioned hypocrisy. In doing so, lives are blighted and the law risks being made an ass. That's one perspective. The other, that the duty of law and medicine is to protect and preserve life, not facilitate death, no matter how extreme the circumstance. If that boundary is crossed, if law and medicine have the basic ground rules changed, then there is no easy way to prevent the slide towards life being seen as a consumer commodity to be assessed on the same basis as any other commodity. Reopening the door to eugenics and the disposal of those deemed to be either an economic or a cultural liability. In short, that door is the door to Europe of the 1930s. Well, one of the key actors in the drama are the religious communities of Australia, the sacredness of life being a key plank in any understanding of a creator who loves the creation. Indeed, some go so far as to say religious groups are the problem with the whole issue. The Atheist Foundation of Australia blames religion for the continued restrictions on assisted suicide. Recently, they observed, and I'll quote, "The world is being very dishonestly misled into thinking that the subject of voluntary euthanasia is full of controversy and is in need of endless debate. Those directly responsible for this unfortunate state of affairs are a small collection of vociferous religious people, hell-bent on keeping control over life and death, no matter what the cost." Well, tonight we thought we would ask a selection of that small collection of religious people to discuss the issue of assisted death. In a moment, we'll be joined by individuals from the Jewish, Catholic, Buddhist and Protestant traditions to share their personal reflections on the matter. And you too may like to join the conversation. 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222. If you are in South Australia or the Northern Territory, give us a ring right now. Your observations on euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the way the Australian government, Australian state governments and federal governments are handling the issue. 1300 800 222. Are too many people suffering unnecessarily, both those who desire a good death and those who are assisting them? Or does the government rightly act cautiously when it comes to the matter of the preservation of life? In our second hour, something of a change. The man dubbed as one of America, by Time magazine at least, as one of America's top 100 influential Americans for the year 2006. Known popularly in the United States as Bush's housing czar, Philip Mangano. As the debate on homelessness cranks up in Australia, we hear from someone who says the answer to the ills of the homeless is housing first. Independent living is the first step on the way to a restructured life. Philip Mangano, in about an hour's time. Then, of course, the Midnight Inquisition, a crisis update from Burma with Noel Debien, and some tunes. Now, around that time, some of you may be leaving us for the cricket, but for those sticking around, as I said earlier, we'll be continuing with a net broadcast and retired Bishop Geoffrey Robinson, a retired Catholic bishop causing quite a stir internationally with his recently published book, Confronting Sex and Power in the Catholic Church. As a final hour special, we'll be replaying Noel Debien's interview with Geoffrey Robinson, conducted just a couple of months ago. And Geoffrey Robinson's book's taking off in the United States and other places at the moment, so a good place for web listeners to catch up. You're on Sunday Night. Let's have some music. And here's something from Foster and Allen. True Love Ways, an old Buddy Holly song.
Just you know why. Why you and I will by and by know true love ways. Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry, and you know why. Just you and I, no true love ways. Throughout the day, our true love ways will bring us joys to share with those who really care. Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry, and you know why. Just you and I, no true love ways. The day our true love ways will bring us joys to share with those who really care. Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry. Just you and I, no true love ways.
Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry. Foster and Allen, an old Buddy Holly song. That's Foster and Allen, Songs of Love and Laughter. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia and across the World Wide Web. John Cleary with you. Well, the debate about dying continues to injure the living. Each week, new cases of assisted suicide are brought before the courts in what appears to be a continuation of a culturally sanctioned hypocrisy. Lives are blighted and the law is made an ass. What do the major religious traditions have to say on the subject of assisted suicide, of euthanasia? Well, today, tonight, we're going to find out on Sunday Night as we welcome some of those vociferous fighters in the cause of religion. From the Jewish, Buddhist, Protestant and Catholic traditions, we're joined by Rabbi Paul Jacobson from Temple Emmanuel or Emmanuel Synagogue in Sydney, the Reverend Ian Pearson from Pitt Street Uniting Church, Bernadette Tobin from St. Vincent's Ethics Centre, and the Venerable Ted Adamo, who tells me I must call him Bunte. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here. Ian Pearson, we've got to congratulate you first off that you've come in tonight after a heavy day of celebration, because Pitt Street Uniting, one of Australia's best known uniting churches for all sorts of reasons, has celebrated its 175th anniversary today.
We certainly have, yes.
Glad you could crawl in and make it.
Well, I'm not sure whether I'm awake, but I'm delighted.
175 years, a remarkable tradition. It's always been a church in the centre of Sydney's life.
Well, it was in the centre of a small town to begin with, which grew into a city, and it's changed its outlook. It's changed its geographical footprint. Changed many things through the years. It's been up and down. It's almost died a number of times, but we're still there.
Ian Pearson, great to have you with us, and Thanks for being part of this conversation. Let me first ask each of you for a personal reflection. That song of Foster and Allen, Songs of Love and Laughter, Sometimes We Laugh, Sometimes We Cry, the sadness of it. Euthanasia, assisted suicide, ultimately has to be something that can only be dealt with in a sense, in an intensely personal way. There's something that is visceral about an issue such as this. Ian, given that I congratulated you first, you're first cab off the rank.
It certainly is intensely personal, but it's also in community. That can create the problems that the community tries to regulate too much, and yet the community can protect as well. The community can help people, for instance, who are depressed and who may need some help to get beyond depression, and that's possible, to get over a hurdle and resume the joy of life again. But then it is personal. It's particular in every case. And the difficulty is, how do you work out the difference between murder, for instance, and assisted suicide? Death is a complex issue. There are many ways of dying, and sometimes the law draws fine lines between them. So it's a very difficult subject. I don't find it easy to talk in black and white about this subject.
Teja Damo, the Buddhist tradition puts a particularly strong emphasis on the sacredness of life. Euthanasia, that is, how and when life should end, is that in the hands of the individual, or should it be in the hands of the individual, or is it something that needs to be left ultimately to fate?
Well, whether we like it or not, it's in the hands of the individual anyway, isn't it? We can legislate and we can have all sorts of philosophical and theological views, but finally it's in a person's own hands. From the Buddhist perspective, it involves suffering, it involves dukkha, this suffering and unsatisfactoriness. And the whole point of the Buddha's teaching is for the overcoming of dukkha and suffering and unsatisfactoriness.
Does that mean it has to be born?
No, but it also, from a Buddhist perspective, it also means that the simple answer to ending suffering is not necessarily death.
That takes us right into actually being a participant in the Buddhist way.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. All right, we might come back to that in a moment. The Jewish tradition, Paul Jacobson, the Jewish tradition, it picks up on something that Ian Pearson said. This idea of community is very strong in the Jewish tradition.
Absolutely. In the Jewish tradition, community is something that is incredibly strong, and community is something that helps keep us together as a people for
So in a sense, we are not individuals when this decision is made.
In a sense, we're not individuals, and in a sense, there's an overarching teaching, or teachings, we might say, that have been handed down to us through the generations, through our rabbis, through our sages, through our teachers.
And those teachings go to where?
Those teachings offer the perspective probably mostly originating with the biblical tradition, and then continuing later in the rabbinic tradition, the notion that all life is sacred, and that all life as well, we have to do whatever we can to go ahead and preserve and protect life.
That statement as a general principle would be something that everyone in this room would agree with, and perhaps mm-hmm. most supporters of euthanasia even mm-hmm. would agree with. It gets down ultimately to slicing and dicing in the most difficult sense. Bernadette Tobin, the Catholic Church, has spent many years as specialists in moral and ethical slicing and dicing. And it's something that you've made a profession of. That is, how actually to work with these difficult issues. Because ultimately, when you get closer and closer to an issue like this, the boundaries actually cease being black and white and seem to become grey.
John, I think the Catholic tradition has got a wonderfully clear teaching on this subject matter. I think the difficulties are dealing with the challenges that death and dying bring to individuals. But the teaching's very clear. It reminds us of an idea that comes, that the Greeks knew and the Hebrews knew, and that is that human life is a precious gift, as Kant said, a gift of inestimable worth. So it's something for me
it's
to
the
value.
The only one we have ultimately, yes. Isn't each of us as individuals.
It's something for me to value. But the Catholic tradition has always taught that that valuing does not require me to undergo every form of suffering that might be visited on me. And in particular, if medical treatment that will keep me alive is either ineffective towards its goal, which is to heal me, or it's overly burdensome, I have no duty to accept it. And I may freely and joyfully accept a shorter life than a longer life. So I think it's a wonderfully clear teaching. Of course, killing either of myself or anybody else is out of the question. Do not kill. Of course it is.
So this is when the argument really begins to bite. When we get from the area of, say, somebody saying, no, stop the treatment, I want to get off the bus, just leave me here, and they have a perfect right to do that. What then becomes the issue is what's called assisted suicide, when either friends, family, carers, doctors, whatever, somebody goes to them and says, I want off the bus. And their suffering is such that those closest to them say, yeah, that's a fair enough thing, we'll help you get off the bus.
But John, I want off the bus is a deeply ambiguous claim. I want off the bus might mean no more chemotherapy for me because it's not achieving any therapeutic goal, or it's coming at too great a cost for me. It might mean that. And those kinds of decisions ought to be respected and reinforced and enabled. But that's quite different either from suicide or from killing someone else. And that's quite different from assisting someone to commit suicide.
And it's this area of assisting that really gets us into the difficulties. Ian, I'll come back to you on this. And please feel free to, if you've got observations, to make them and come over an argument, you know, just jab in and say, shut up, I've got something to say here. Please feel free to do that. Ian, assisted suicide, let's get to that. The United Church has groups, moral groups, looking at these areas. Are there any grounds on which assisted suicide, conditionally assisted suicide, can be found to be acceptable?
I don't speak on behalf of the Uniting Church, John.
Ian Pearson, from your depth of experience as somebody who's had to deal with people working through these issues over the years.
Yes, I come really as a pastor, and as all of us do in one way or another. And it is difficult when people face end of life. The question, first of all, is this the antithetical? I mean, is life antithetical to death? That's one thing. Or is death a summation of a life? And so that, you know, the way you approach it can affect the way you make your decision making as well. And therefore, how you experience death too. But death as part of life is an important part of the way we can view things. When we do that, then death itself is not necessarily scary.
Painful.
It could be painful.
And we may want to get out of it. We may want to say, no, end the pain. Thank you. The pain is too great.
That's right.
And I need help to do this.
And I think that for different people at different times of life, then it's weighing up the extent of the pain, the extent of the despair, whether there can be intervention in order to assist in that. Or not. And different people have different levels that they can work to as well.
So you would say there's not a definitive religious line that can be drawn here?
I don't tend to think in blacks and whites. I think that there are many colours of the spectrum.
Rabbi
and
Paul,
that makes it difficult, I think.
Rabbi Paul, you wanted to say something there.
I think that there's a very fine line in the Jewish tradition, and that's the fine line that exists between, one, understanding that we do not believe in any form of assisted suicide. We do not believe in any form of hastening a person's death. But at the same time, we do believe that we should go about relieving a person's suffering as best as we possibly can. And that includes, from a number of our rabbinic texts, removing any impediments that may be preventing a person from dying in a peaceful way.
So this is the pumping up the morphine argument, and this is one that constantly comes up. Teja Dhamma, from the Buddhist tradition, would you have anything that would prevent a doctor, say, if a patient is lying there, they know they're terminal, they know they've only got a matter of hours, days, or perhaps even a week or so to go, and they are in considerable suffering, and the morphine pump is just pressed a little, relieving pain, but at some point the boundary between pain relief and the inhibition of respiration takes place. You cross a boundary and the morphine may in fact stop breathing.
But the important thing from the Buddhist point of view is the chedana, or the intention of the doctor. And if the doctor's intention is to relieve pain, and the doctor's using what's considered to be an acceptable method to relieve pain, even if we know that if this level continues to be increased, the person will eventually stop breathing. That's not the primary intention of what the doctor or whoever it is doing.
But all of us know cases where people have been in situations dying. We've been close family, friends, or maybe even our immediate family, where we know that the doctor in those last hours has just said, look, I'll just push the morphine a little and really, you know, the suffering will end more quickly.
Well, I think we know and we don't know, frankly. I think we assume lots of things as to what's really going on, and to know the mind of another person, to be able to say as clearly as you're suggesting that that what really the doctor is doing is that, I'd be very careful about jumping to that kind of conclusion myself.
I think doctors are concerned about people thinking that that's what's happening too. Mm-hmm. But I've been present in the situations that you describe, where a member of the family might ask the question of a doctor, and the doctor will assure them, well, we will reduce the pain, and obviously the...
That certain inevitable consequences will follow.
But John, remember, people who... we owe it to people who are dying to heal them as they die, radically to relieve the symptoms, radically to relieve pain, radically to address breathlessness and anxiety, all the physical symptoms, and we owe it to them to address the psychological symptoms of dying too.
Well, there's a quick way to do that. You pump the morphine up.
Well, no, John, I'm talking about the goal being to heal a person, to make the person whole as best we can as that person dies. So the Catholic tradition is radical about that we have deep responsibilities there, and they have to be rethought and rethought with every advance in medicine. Now, morphine, properly administered, kills no one. But there are things that sometimes someone might be dying of a cancer of the throat and fears choking to death. Sedating that person so that they sleep out the last part of their lives might be what you have a responsibility to do. That person will die sooner than they would have had you not done that. That's good palliative care, and it's what we ought to be doing more often than we are.
Rabbi, in that situation?
In that situation, it's actually... In that kind of situation, when you are faced with someone's suffering in that kind of capacity, and I've had the opportunity, well, I wouldn't exactly call it an opportunity. I mean, I've had situations both on a personal level and on a rabbinic level where it's necessary to do whatever you possibly can to alleviate a person's suffering and to help them. And I would add from another perspective, and this brings us back to the comments that we were making at the beginning about the importance of community. It's not just religion's role to assist and to help the person who is dying, but it's also important to be there as a source of support for the family and a source of support for other people. And on a rabbinic or on a pastoral level, that also includes being supportive for hospital staff, for doctors and for nurses and for anyone who's in that situation. So the teachings of religion, I think, extend one for caring for people who are, of course, dying and in need of that support, but also to their families and also to a higher level beyond
that. So the notion of community critically depends on the definition of life, doesn't it, really? I mean, we exist as groups of people, and the way we define coming into that community and going out of that community are ultimately life and death. And that's why we have arguments about when is a fetus viable or what's life, and now we're having arguments about what the end of the process is, because in a way we're determining the boundaries of community responsibility by these actions. That's why, I guess, this immediately becomes a major concern for civil society and questions of law. That even if in the difficult areas, in that sort of, even if the dark night of the soul or wherever, in the wee small hours of the morning, a decision is taken, even if that at the moment of that decision it's a very complex judgment and subtle judgment to make, nevertheless, standing in the light of day, you still have to draw clear boundaries. The law has to draw clear boundaries. Would you say that, Bernadette?
I think so. John, I think there are three very powerful reasons why the law shouldn't legalise the deliberate killing of very sick people, even those who want us to do that. One is, do not kill, that which is the foundation of all law. Secondly, I think it will corrupt the character of doctors and the character of medicine. And thirdly, it will provide a quick fix for us to deal with people whose care puts enormous burdens on the rest of us. So I think there are very powerful reasons for the law to stay out of this and not legalise it. But that said, that's the context, and then we have the goal of ensuring that people die as well as they can according to our own capacities, and we've got to rethink them, as I say, with every development in medicine.
Ian?
Well, there's black letter law and there's other law. And law runs into difficulties sometimes when it gets in beyond the black letter law. I think that the black letter law can be killing, whether it comes from the church or whether it comes from civil society. It seems to me that the goal of law, of medicine, of pastoral care, of family, when somebody is dying, is to, in Christian terms, seek for something like a sacrament. It seems to me that in many deaths that I've been there for, that it has been a sacramental experience. And it's not always easy to bring that about. And I don't know that law by itself can bring it about. On the other hand, I think that the law needs to facilitate those ways that facilitate sacrament. Now, that means, it seems to me, that there do need to be safeguards in place. That's part of what community means, so that people are not forced to endure a death that they do not want to participate in, either as somebody who might be assisting somebody in their death, or as somebody who is being killed, if you want to put it that way. But to achieve something like sacrament, which can be just a marvellous experience for all concerned.
But we see so often, and it seems to be, it's an increasing phenomenon that we see in front of the courts. Let's leave aside the Philip Nitschke argument. Let's leave aside the whole doctor death argument. Let's go to an aged couple, one desperately seeing the other partner suffering and wants to assist, and the way out is an assisted suicide. We see them dragged before the courts, threatened with jail. We see the whole weight of society bear down upon them in their already grief-stricken lives. I mean, should society act, even though it's in the preservation of life, so it says, should it bring down the wrath of the law in such a heavy sense in those situations?
Well, I think that's a different question, though, to the question of whether euthanasia is something which is morally or ethically good. I think that's an entirely different question. And that really brings up the question of the kind of society that we live in and whether enough resources and enough attention is paid to people at the end of their life. And in my own view, the answer is very simple, no. I think people are pushed to one side. People don't want to know about it. And one of the things that worries me about a rush to euthanasia is that underneath what can appear to be a concern to relieve suffering, and people often talk about it's the compassionate thing to do, compassion can have many faces, and compassion can be driven by wrong thinking or wrong intention. And so I think...
But those people in that situation, yes, that couple maybe in their sort of early 80s, who are basically rational people, still got their wits about them, say, no, this is the way to go. And we've seen examples of that before the courts.
But they're free human beings. Of course, they have the right as free individuals to choose that. But whether that's, in any ultimate sense, a good choice is another question altogether.
But should one partner be punished for helping the other?
Well, you're asking a Buddhist monk. I'm not a lawyer. My compassionate answer would be no. They should be helped as much as possible.
Yeah. Bernadette.
John, I think it's a genuinely difficult question. I think the law should be very clear on this, and that the deliberate killing of even sick people who want it should be illegal. I think that should be very clear. But should we be rushing to prosecute a couple or one part of a couple, as you say? No, I don't think so. Why would our energies go there? Surely they should go in other places. However, I recognise that a law that is disobeyed, a law that kind of lapses, is a bad law. So I think it is a genuinely difficult question.
Because it does create difficulties for the law here. The law risks being made an ass.
Sure it does, exactly. I think, and which is why I think it's a very hard question. But doesn't it mean that our energy should be going into trying to ensure that these occasions don't arise? I mean, even in a city with the wonderful palliative medicine facilities that we've got today, some people get the benefit of them and others simply don't. Now, these are things that we can address, tricky though they are and challenging though they are. That's where I think our energy should go, rather than prosecuting a little old couple like that.
Mm. Rabbi?
We have a number of teachings from our tradition that express that, one, recognizing that doctors and all human beings accept that all life is sacred. That is something that we believe very firmly as Jews. But included in those perspectives is the notion that you don't take advantage of anybody and you don't exploit anybody. And specifically, there are commands against exploiting people who are widows, people who are poor, people who have no ability to defend or to speak for themselves. And if euthanasia were to be allowed on a certain level, then how is that stopping people from allowing along a slippery slope and moving down in that way and saying that life is no longer sacred, life is no longer precious, so anybody can choose to end their life at any point without any penalty? The notion is that life...
Get hold of the family jewels early.
It could be one way of looking at it, exactly.
Yes. Yes. Let me raise a couple of other issues. We're going to take some calls in just a moment. Bernadette, you raised an issue there about that wasn't the sort of increasing the morphine drip, but was about other sorts of palliative care. And I think there are two or three examples here which do stand out. We have the example, of course, of those who were at the other end of life, born severely handicapped with no chance to live a normal life and only minimal chance of survival without major medical intervention. What should happen there?
Well, again, I think, John, we have old principles that help us decide those extremely difficult cases. And they are that though human life is a wonderful, precious thing, if the treatment that's required to keep someone alive is ineffective towards a reasonably therapeutic goal, or if it's overly burdensome, then it may be forgone. And that's absolutely central to the Catholic tradition. And I don't think that's easily applied to every single case of a disabled newborn child, but I think it gives you a context from which to reach good decisions.
And what about, Ian, I'll come to you on this one, the other area that Bernadette raised, the area of limited and costly medical resources. That is, if society has to ration its medical treatment, when we get to a person and say, look, they're too old and infirm, I don't think we can justify the expense of this radical intervention in saving them. That's a sort of passive euthanasia on one level, but you get to the point where you think, no, hang on, really, we are splitting hairs here, because we know if we did intervene, we could save that person.
Well, this is close to my heart. I actually have a daughter with cystic fibrosis. She was born with a complication of that disease, which meant that, and then it developed a further complication, which meant that the first 10 months of her life were hell. I really feel for medical communities that actually have to fund that, because when she was kept from death with four major experiences of surgery, the bed costs of an intensive care neonatal nursery, so all of that expense, she was preserved and is now 25, the community is still continuing to pay for her medical expenses. So I really feel for health administrators. I have to say, though, that I'm delighted that the community has facilitated the life of my daughter. In many, many ways, she's costly to run, if you like, from the point of view of the community. She has brought an enormous amount of joy, not only to my wife and I, and to our family, but to other people as well, even in the midst of her disability. And I've observed this with many other people. I think of a young woman who is heavily disabled, and she constantly has, you know, good Christians telling her that if she had enough faith, then she would be healed and that kind of thing. And she has developed a saying, look, I am healed, I'm just not cured. And I think that healing and cure can operate on different levels. It's just a really complicated business.
Time to take some calls. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. If you'd like to join us on the web, abc.net.au/Sunday Nights. And let's go to Yolanda in Sydney. If all we in the studio put on our headphones, we can say hi to Yolanda. Hello, Yolanda. Welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. There is just so much that I can say on this topic. And in waiting, I've been getting a bit confused on what I can say. I'll just give a little bit about my history. I'm 40, but 10 years ago I got cancer and a very serious brain injury that's led me basically very housebound and disabled. I used to fear for my future tremendously. I used to be scared. And even though I have a very poor memory, I remember years and years and years ago going searching on the internet on how to commit suicide because I didn't, before I knew of the existence of euthanasia, because I was just so scared because I knew of the future potential risks that I had, bearing in mind my medical problems. And one evening, you on ABC had Patria King and Philip Nitschke talking about voluntary euthanasia, and I had never heard of it before. And I tuned in and I heard it, and that night I slept better than I had slept ever. My mind was at peace, absolute peace. Now, if you don't mind, I'll just keep on going. Is that okay, John?
Well, very briefly, but it's been terrific what you said.
The main problem with euthanasia is that 80% of the population support it. However, most of the people that are faced with wanting to support it sooner rather than later, they're elderly or sick, and so they can't really do things to put forward their case. Many seniors don't have internet, almost none. That when I went to a meeting, I asked them to put their hands up, the New South Wales Association meeting, and out of a room of about 60, 70 people, only two people put their hand up. If you look at me, I've been waiting now on the phone for 40 minutes. I've been wanting to hang up because I was just so exhausted. I can't do very much, even on the computer. So how we can't get the message across. And so it's up to people like Philip Nitschke to do things that stretch the law, because no one else is wanting to listen to us. Apart from the fact that 80% of people believe that a law should be put in that has the right safeguards. For example, in Europe, globally there are four places in the world that have legalised voluntary euthanasia. And every study done for every journal, whether it be medical journal or ethical journal, whatever, they have found that there have been no increase in deaths by utilising euthanasia when it was legalised. There were no increased deaths, so it didn't have a it didn't result in people wanting to jump and jump into dying sooner. They have no the hospital deaths, the medical system, everything. The studies have found have not gone in a negative way ever since euthanasia has been legalised, and that's in Belgium, Switzerland, Oregon, and one other place. Anyway.
It's very important what you said, Yolanda, and I'll take you back almost to the first thing you said, that once you found that you could participate by voluntary euthanasia, if you wished, by joining the society, you found a great sense of relief, knowing that ultimately there could be a voluntary way out for you. And I'll just get the reaction from some of our panellists to that. Yes,
that, Yana? As well?
Sorry?
Can I just mention one other
thing? Yeah, briefly.
About studies that on that very principle. Studies have shown that when people in the countries that where it's legalised, studies have shown that patients actually live longer when they know they have access to a future which isn't going to be painful and stressful and in a way that they're going to be scared. When they have nothing to fear about the future, they actually live longer. Studies have shown that. So in other words, just like me, if I knew that I would have a safeguard, because I am high risk of stroke, of cancer, of another bout of dementia and things, if I knew I had no suffering in the future, I would not go and, for example, take my life sooner while I still had my cognitive abilities. I wouldn't do that.
Well, you're doing it very well tonight. You're doing a very good job of demonstrating that you're not short on cognitive abilities by any means. So thanks for your observations. Bernadette.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in what Yolanda says. There's a lot of disagreement and confusion about what's included under that term euthanasia. And when Yolanda says that 80% of people are in favour of its legalisation, I query that because
surveys do indicate a majority, though, don't they?
Well, but even there, John, you know, there's running together of the withdrawing, withholding of futile or overly burdensome treatment with the deliberate taking of a person's life, and they, both those things get rolled into the term euthanasia. So I doubt that it's quite that much. But even if it were, we would still have to ask, and would that be a good thing for our society for it to be legalised? And I know that Yolanda thinks it would be a good thing, but I think there are very strong reasons for thinking that on balance it wouldn't be. And I guess we just have to disagree there.
Tejadama.
Well, I'd like to come back to something Yolanda mentioned at the very beginning, and that was this question of fear. Because this, in the teaching of the Buddha, this is very, very important. That is the overcoming of fear. And from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha would say that there are three things that we should avoid. One is continually craving a sensual form of existence. The other one is continually craving existence in itself, so endless existence. And the third one is craving the ending of existence. So if we're going to live without fear, we have to find a way to live avoiding those three traps, one of which is the desire for the ending of existence. And that's what I meant before when I said to you that we seem to assume that death is an answer to this problem. And what I'd like to suggest is that there's actually something underneath that that we seem to not address. And Yolanda's brought it up by talking about fear and the fear of being out of control. And you brought it up when you talked about your hypothetical elderly couple. And it seems to me to, yes, it is an answer, euthanasia. But is it a really an adequate, is it the best answer? Is it a truly human answer, I think, is a different question.
You can see the human dimension in what Yolanda says, though, Ian Pearson, when she said, felt that great sense of relief when she thought, ah, oh, yes. And that has enabled her to live a far more vigorous life, according to what she's saying.
I agree, yes. And I think part of what we're trying to say is that we value life, and I want to hold to that very strongly. And I think that we want to encourage Yolanda and others to experience as much as it's going to give her life as possible.
But the ability to choose death has enabled Yolanda to actually seize hold of life.
I was just coming to that. And I did hear the relief, the release of some sense of burden that she experienced because she felt there is that option. And I liked the idea that assisted death is an option. It's not the only one, but the fact that it is an option for Yolanda, I hear, is releasing something for her. I really feel for what Yolanda has to cope with in life. And sometimes when we move into the philosophical, we can actually move away from the day-to-day.
The intimate personal pain of it, yes.
But the thing I think that we're still overlooking is that it's not actually death that people want. What people want is the ending of suffering. And what I'm trying to suggest all the time is that the death and the ending of suffering, certainly from a Buddhist perspective, they are not the same thing.
No? Rabbi, you want to say something?
Exactly. You know, I must say that listening to Yolanda's comments, one, I'm just amazed by her, as she mentioned with her own words, her own cognitive abilities, and just the bravery, the courageousness that she spoke, you know, live with this kind of situation that she's facing. And it's hard from a perspective as a rabbi or as somebody who's not going through these circumstances to be able to say words or to offer words of comfort or healing or even hope in such a difficult moment. But at the same time, I think that I have to agree with a number of the panelists that have spoken this evening that is death necessarily what is desired, or is it the end of that suffering? And how, while someone is alive, can you help to alleviate their suffering and help to ensure that they can live to the best of their ability?
There's a therapeutic element, though, in the actual capacity to choose that Yolanda is suggesting is as being enormously assisting to her, in mm-hmm. just knowing that that capacity for choice that will end the suffering is there, and that in itself is a therapy. That's a challenging thought. Yolanda, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
We are going to have to move on, but you've been very helpful to us. Thanks very much.
Thanks very, very much, John. Bye.
Good night. To Norma in Mackay in Queensland. Hello, Norma. How are you?
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for listening. I was listening to Yolanda, but I wanted to say that in 83 in Canberra, I feel that my daughter was euthanized. She was 48 hours old and she had a massive brain hemorrhage. And they asked my husband and I if they could turn off the machine. And they did, and they took us into this little quiet room and gave us half a bottle of scotch. And they sat there and drank it with us and they cried. Now, was that legal euthanasia? Also, I'm not terribly Christian, and I've listened to all the panel, and I'm not terribly atheist. But that poor little girl, if she'd lived, they said the brain hemorrhage was so massive that she would never be able to feed herself. She would never know who you were. She'd just be a vegetable. So we thought, We just nodded. Yes, please turn off the machine, which they did. And as I said, the staff were as upset or more upset than we were.
And that stayed with you ever since?
I feel that was euthanasia.
Do you think it was the right thing to do?
Yes, I have no conscience about it because since then I had a son, but he has mental illness. And I understand the difference between supporting existing people with illness and supporting somebody who'll never be anybody.
Bernadette, you work around a hospital environment. You must see these sorts of decisions confronting medical staff now and again.
Yes, but it's generally speaking, it's very clear to them whether a decision is a case of deliberately bringing about someone's death, or whether it's a case of deciding that the treatment that's available would be ineffective or overly burdensome. And so that...
Excuse me, Bernadette. Do you think my daughter was euthanized?
It's hard to tell. I must say that my first reaction to the way you described it is that no, she wasn't. But, you know, I wasn't there and I don't know what was going on in the minds of those who made those decisions. But this I do know.
They gave me lovely pictures of her and sat her on my knee and took photos so I'd have closure.
Well, what I was going to say was that I wouldn't expect anybody ever to get over that tragedy, whether it was euthanasia or not. And that's the thing that comes across to me there. And it doesn't surprise me that you're still thinking about that and evaluating it and living with the tragedy of it all these years later.
Mm. But something that really you can't know, and you can't know over the mind of the doctors, except that perhaps they're making a judgment that things are for the best and honestly.
Look, it sounded to me as though they were saying that treatment would be inadvisable. Life-prolonging treatment would be inadvisable.
Thank you very much, Norma, for your call and for sharing that with us. To George in Norwood. George, you there? George, let me come to you there.
Yes, I'm
here. Thank you.
Yes, I'm here. Very briefly. I mean, pity the human who has deteriorated to the extent that they can't access available euthanasia, such as death by gum tree, the short step over the high cliff, the swim to China, the exhaust pipe hose into the car, the pills, the rope, the trip to reality countries, and yet... You know, my cats, lovely creatures, and you can be jarred for not euthanizing a cat that's suffering. I've had to have a couple put down, and I really regretted it, but of course it was my duty.
Yes, no, you're actually saying something semi-lighthearted way, but you're actually raising a very important point. What we're actually saying here is that we're putting such a value on the sense of community boundaries and preserving the sacredness of life that we're actually prepared to subject humans to situations that we wouldn't put our animals through. Ian Pearson.
I agree with that. I think it is important for us to value life enormously. One of the things that I find that...
Get you to do it briefly. We're running out of time. Eh?
Yes, yes. Doctors are often surprised that they make life and death decisions and people accept that without getting a second opinion. It seems to me that that's one of the safeguards that we can exercise at any point in our lives, and I think that that's very important. That's part of community too.
Are we so concerned about the boundaries of life we're prepared to make people suffer?
Not prepared to make people suffer at all. I think the notion that Judaism teaches is that suffering should be relieved to the best of the medical knowledge and capability, and that when medical forms of so-called healing are no longer doing their job, then those impediments to a person's death may be removed so that they may die as peacefully as possible.
Tejadamo, briefly.
Well, unfortunately, for Buddhists, the Buddha teaches that the whole of life is dukkha, is unsatisfactory, is suffering. So the idea that we can reach a point where, especially physically, we can have no suffering from a Buddhist perspective is a nonsense.
Bernadette Tobin, the final word.
That great responsibility and challenge we have to look after people to the best of our intelligence and our heart as they die. That's, I think, the challenge.
Thank you for joining us on Sunday night. It's been good to have you with us. Rabbi Paul Jacobson, Reverend Ian Pearson, Bernadette Tobin and the Venerable Tejadamo. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio.